This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're going to have a conversation today that some people might find a little touchy, but why avoid it? It's part of life, and at the moment, it's a crucial aspect of public life. We're going to talk about age in American politics, old age. It wasn't so long ago, at least not to me, that Ronald Reagan was considered by many as over the hill, too old to govern. But now we have a president who's turned 80 in the middle of his first term, and even some of Joe Biden's supporters have expressed concerns about him starting a second term. If he wins and he endures, he'd be 86 at the end of it. Donald Trump, who's still on the scene, insists that Biden, of course, isn't up to the job. Pretty strong words from someone who was a decade past Social Security age. So we're going to hear today from two of our keenest observers of American political life, historian Jill Lepore and our Washington correspondent, Jane Mayer.
This is not a new problem. I think of, you know, Strom Thurmond. I think he left office at age 100, wasn't it?
Yeah, but he only looked 99, so you know, don't be harsh.
But he and Jesse Helms, the two senators, sat through the Clinton impeachment asleep.
First, though, I wanted to get some facts from a medical perspective. Jack Rowe is an expert on the science of aging. Dr. Rowe founded the Division on Aging at Harvard Medical School, and he now serves as professor of health policy and aging at Columbia University. I'd like to begin this conversation by asking you how you think about this, how we should think about this, first as a matter of medicine and as something that we can or cannot predict.
I think if we start with just the facts are confusing for people because you can read that the average life expectancy in the United States is 78, which is true. So is somebody who's 80 on borrowed time? It's understandable that people would think that those people are really on the way out. But the fact is, life expectancy on average is 78 at birth. Mm-hmm. But if you make it to 80, your life expectancy is, on average, another 10 years.
I think the conversation, though, is not about life expectancy. The conversation is about looking at the presidency as an extremely difficult, high-stress job that demands a lot, ideally, of the office holder intellectually, politically, and just in sheer physical stamina. And wondering if it's, in the case of Joe Biden or anyone, even at this late date when life expectancies, as you say, have gotten longer, particularly for people who've had good medical care, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea.
Yeah. I think that there is an exaggeration of the importance of some of the characteristics that occur with advancing age. President Biden has some verbal slips that he makes. Maybe they're more common than they used to be, maybe not. He seems to be a little frail in walking. Mm-hmm. Franklin Roosevelt couldn't walk at all. He was a pretty effective president. So drawing a straight line between the, you know, inability to walk as well as you did before or ride a bike quite as well as he rides a bike. The fact that he rides a bike at all is impressive. But I do think, obviously, that older people are more frail than younger people. Mm-hmm. Let's not deny that.
Just for the record, I'm 64. How old are you?
I'm 78.
Fair enough. Okay.
And
I think, let's even, you know, I hope you don't mind my asking, I voted for Joe Biden. Did you?
Yes.
And do you think that influences the way you see this?
No. The two candidates were very similar in age from my point of view. Age wasn't a factor. The fundamental finding here of decades of research, David, is that the older people become, the less like each other they become. All 30 or 40-year-olds are pretty much the same in terms of the kidney function or lung function, immune function, cardiac function, even cognitive function. But as you get out to 80, there's tremendous heterogeneity. And while the average 80-year-old is quite a bit lower in function than the average 30-year-old on many factors, there are always 80-year-olds who perform like the average 30-year-old. And
does Joe Biden seem like what? No, again, you have not examined him, we should stipulate, obviously.
Nor have I read his medical records.
But you watch him on television and that's follow the news as carefully as you can. So those are the limits of your... Yeah.
So when we look at the drivers of this variability, successful agers, people in the top quartile, are white, well-educated, financially secure, and have a good social structure. They are not alone. The average life expectancy between an educated, white, well-off, married man and a poor, black, uneducated, single man is 13 years. So when we look at people like President Biden, we look at a kind of super agers. My colleagues and I at Harvard years ago did a study of very successfully aging 75-year-olds. And we studied their cognitive performance and their physical performance in detail. We followed them for 6 years. 50% of them did much less well than they had at the outset. But 25% of them didn't change, starting at age 75 or 76. Mm-hmm. Remarkable.
But we're talking about somebody who will be closer to 90 than he will be to 80 if he has a second term and lives it out.
Yes. I'm not trying to paint a picture which is denying aging. I'm just trying to clarify what it is that we actually know.
It seems to me what's going on, it's usually a purely political weapon or other people perhaps not wanting to discuss it at all for fear of giving points to the other side.
Completely, completely. And I think one of the dimensions that's worth considering here are the psychological changes. Mm-hmm. There have been a number of studies published recently showing that older people fared much better during COVID than younger people. They had more emotional balance. And this is consistent with the literature showing that they have less anger, less fear, less sadness, that they react less negatively to things that happen in the environment.
Fair enough. But let me put a little bit of pressure on your points here.
And, sure.
And when we observe President Biden, who I think, from my point of view anyway, has had a certain number of really considerable successes, both in foreign policy and domestic policy in the last couple of years, when I see him in a press conference, I see a press conference very often organized to have minimal questions. He has cards in which he very often picks up and starts reading from. There's not the same fluidity that you would have recognized in, say, in Obama or any number of other presidents, whether you like them or not. It seems pretty clear to me that his staff, recognizing his strengths and his limitations, have come up with workarounds to deal with this, and it might not get better. How do you respond to that?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that were the case. The question is that disqualifying? Is it doesn't invoke tremendous confidence, but at the same time, I don't feel that some of those factors, or his age, or even aspects of medical history, explain how he's going to function. I tell my students, if you're going to see an elderly man, and he's 78 years old, and he's had a history of a heart attack and high blood pressure, and that's the only information I give you, you can't tell me whether that man is in a nursing home or on the Supreme Court of the United States. Mm-hmm. One of the other psychological dimensions that I find interesting is that older people repeatedly in studies have been shown to solve disagreements between various parties better than younger people. Younger people strive for justice in what they view as justice. Older people tend to strive for win-win situations.
We all remember the Reagan years, or at least I do, and certainly you do. No matter what you thought about Ronald Reagan's politics, I think it's fair to say that in the standard intellectual sense, he was never a giant. But there came a time when he began showing distinct deficits, and not long after he left office, it was announced that he, in fact, had Alzheimer's. These kinds of conditions are not like a light switch. It's not off one day and on the next. How much concern should we have when we look at a politician, somebody with great responsibility in his or her hands, who's in their 80s, having that kind of decline? Not forgetting names, you know, I can't find my keys.
It sounds like you have trouble with names.
I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
So we're taking that off the table.
Right.
That's normal.
That's exactly right. You read
that's
my
normal.
Mind. You read my mind, such as it is. But, how do we think about that?
Of course, cognitive impairment increases with advancing age.
Mm-hmm.
Your chance of having Alzheimer's disease is probably 10% at age 65 and 4 times that at age 85.
It's a big difference.
Huge. There is a large group of people who have what is called mild cognitive impairment. And some of those go on to have Alzheimer's disease and some don't. I don't think, from what I can see, and I watch a lot of news, political news, of President Biden or even former President Trump, that they have any evidence of cognitive impairment at this stage. If they were having significant cognitive impairment, they shouldn't run for office, period. Now, the question is, should we give them a test of some sort?
I'm asking, yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't be against it.
You remember that fantastic moment with Trump described that he had been given a cognitive test.
Like you'll go person, woman, man, camera, TV. 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes later, they say, remember the first question? Not the first, but the 10th question? Give us that again. Can you do that again? And you go person, woman, man, camera, TV. They say, that's amazing. How did you do that? I do it because I have, like, a good memory, because I'm cognitively there.
That doesn't seem to me an adequate test.
There are very standard tests that have been given to millions of people. That's not one of them.
What are they like?
There's a simple one called the mini mental state exam, where they'll start by asking what date it is and who the president is and where we are. And then they'll ask you to draw a pentagram or something like that. Then they'll ask you some questions. When I was training at the Massachusetts General Hospital, I used to tell patients at the beginning of the interview that number 12 Walnut Street on Beacon Hill has a red door. Repeat that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So there's number 12, there's Walnut Street, Beacon Hill, red door, right? Four facts. Things like that.
Okay, but a president of the United States not only has to deal with that sentence, he or, God willing, someday she has to deal with trying to figure out fiscal policy, how to cope with China and Taiwan, Ukraine crisis, and the absolute fire hydrant of daily crisis that come mm-hmm. at a president on a daily basis. This is not a 9-to-5 job. This is not being, you know, dad who comes in 3 days a week to deal with the family real estate a business while the son or daughter is actually running. It's the presidency. It's consuming in a way that turns them all gray and prematurely old. What effect does that have on one intellectually and physically, that level of stress?
I think it's tremendously variable in general. By the time people get to be running for president of the United States, I think they've differentiated themselves into the group of people who handle it pretty well. I think President Biden has been a politician a long time.
Since his 30s.
Some people say too long.
Yeah.
I think these people are selected into a group, anybody who can run a presidential campaign, talk about, are they going to make it? Are they going to get too tired, et cetera? The presidential campaign is the test. If you can make it through the campaign, that's harder than being president, I would imagine, in some ways.
How much of your viewpoint is influenced by the fact that we live longer and longer? And do you conceive of a day when somebody could easily be president into his or her 90s?
Yes, I do. I do think that we're going to see the emergence of individuals, more individuals, who are fully capable, cognitively and physically and psychologically, to maintain very high function, very, very advanced ages.
So certainly from a medical point of view, you, I would guess, are against any age limits for high office, whether it's Supreme Court or the Senate or the presidency.
Or anything. I mean, it's not realistic. Not only against age limits, but I'm furious about something that we are seeing repeatedly, and that is old age is not a disease, okay? Old people are sick because they're sick, not because they're old. They're more likely to get sick if they're old, of course. But when Prince Philip died, the palace said he died of old age. That was a great setback. We are trying to differentiate age from disease.
What did he die of?
I don't know. But nobody dies of old age. Then when his wife died, more recently, they did it again. Even though there was...
This is Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. God bless her. And geriatric medicine in England is very powerful, very well established, more so than the U.S. They couldn't get them to say, you know, because they didn't want to label her with a disease. And then just when the dust settled, the Vatican said Benedict died of old age. And it just tears my hair. If I had hair, I'd tear it out. So that's ageism.
Yeah.
That's a concrete, specific evidence of ageism.
When Biden mistakenly asks if a deceased congresswoman is in the audience,
including bipartisan elected officials like Representative Governor, Senator Braun, Senator Booker, Representative Jackie, are you here? Where's Jackie? I didn't think she was going
to
be here.
Or he appears to doze off at a meeting, or he falls off his bike, or trips while boarding Air Force One, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
You think, what the hell? That's irrelevant.
I think that's what 80-year-olds do. Am I surprised to see that? No. Would I put him in the rehab unit? No. I don't believe that what we see, which is attributable to his age,
right,
is likely to importantly impair his function as president of the United States. And I think he probably has some other attributes that certainly mitigate any adverse effect of what we see. On balance, I think he's a very successful and fortunate 80-year-old.
Jack Rowe is professor of health policy and aging at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. We're going to continue the conversation about aging and political life in a moment. And I'll be back with Jane Mayer and Jill Lepore. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're talking today about age and the presidency, about how old is too old to be in the White House, if there is such a number. Now, I spoke earlier in the program with Dr. Jack Rowe, a specialist in the science of aging, and his argument is this. As long as your health is good at 80, odds are you'll be fine for a term in the Oval Office. It's no matter if you're less nimble on your feet. He thinks there's a lot of ageism going on, particularly when it comes to Joe Biden. But this is a very complicated issue, and we're going to look at it from some other angles now, including a historical perspective.
I think it's worth noting the change, right? Because first of all, you think just historically, right? In 1790, when 35 was made the minimum age requirement for the presidency, life expectancy for men was, I think, 44. It's 77 now?
Staff writer Jill Lepore is a historian at Harvard University, and she joined me along with Jane Mayer, the New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent. So what should be the theme song from this? When I get older, what do you think? Kids are different today.
64 is so young.
I know, 64 is way too young for these people.
Oh, my God. Well, let's look at this historically first, Jill. Woodrow Wilson had a stroke, and I think his wife basically ran the White House for quite a long time. What is the history of this aging, cognitive difference over time? What is the history of it, and what does it tell you in contemporary terms?
So I think historically the 1920s are the real turning point because life expectancy had risen quite a bit by then. In the 1920s is really when retirement is invented. Geriatrics is invented. The kind of study of old age is founded in the 1920s. So that's when people first start getting really worried about it, noticing that presidents are getting older, not so much inaugurated in their 50s, but maybe into their 60s. And then you start seeing people saying, I won't run because I'm too old. Charles Evans Hughes is pressed in to seek the nomination in 1928s. Maybe 66, something he says, I'm too old. Mm-hmm. Remember, Eisenhower has a heart attack in office, but before he leaves office, he says any man who's 70 should never hold this office. So 70 really is the benchmark into the rise of Ronald Reagan.
Jane, when you watch Joe Biden, and you've watched him for decades now as a professional politician, are you concerned?
Well, I mean, he's never been a nimble speaker, but I think he's less so now. I think also I hear the talk around the White House is that he can be cranky and is particularly testy around the issue of his age, hates the question about it. And
of course he does. I hate the issue.
Right. And his answer is always, well, just watch me, you know. So right. Everybody actually, of course, is watching him very closely. You know, in the period that I have covered the sort of presidents, I came in covering Reagan, who at the time when he was elected in 1980, he was 69 years old, I think. And then what I think we've seen in this modern period is age creep that's relatively, you know, fast moving. So that you then had with Trump, when he was elected in 2016, he was 70 years old. Mm-hmm. So he's older than breaking the record with Reagan. And then you get with Biden 2020, he was 77.
Here's what the pushback would be, certainly from the White House, that Joe Biden, in a very complicated and sui generis political race, beat Donald Trump, beat him soundly, as it turned out, and has had an enormous number of accomplishments, whether you like them or not, in foreign policy and in domestic policy in the course of 2 years. Do you sense that he's being, okay, he's cranky. Bill Clinton was cranky. You know, we can all be cranky. But when the rubber meets the road, is he being hurt by his age? Is there any evidence of that in your reporting or anyone else's?
What I think you have to say is that, first of all, I don't know. It's very hard for a reporter to get the truth on this particular subject, because one of the things that I've learned is that presidents and other very powerful politicians are surrounded by aides and consultants mm-hmm. and a whole village of people whose status derives from them and whose livings often derive from them. And they do cover for the person on the inside. Well,
That's a good point. You broke a story that everybody kind of knew about but failed to write about, is that Dianne Feinstein, who's been a senator for a very long time in California, was clearly having cognitive difficulties. Tell us that story and how it does or does not relate to Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly sad. She is now, I think, 89 years old. She's still in the Senate. And one of her colleagues said to me that, it's painful to watch her. She forgets that she's been briefed on things. She forgets that she's just answered a question or asked a question and repeats the question. One of her colleagues said to me, she is using the Senate as an assisted living facility, and she shouldn't be here.
That's pretty rough.
It was really rough. And these are people who really respect and admire her. And what they're seeing is a, you know, magnificent career diminished. And again, what was interesting to me in reporting on this was, it was clear that in 2018, when she ran for re-election, the people who ran that campaign and who they knew. But there are so many reasons why they push a politician forward and cover such things up. I mean, in this case, Chuck Schumer actually had to speak with Dianne Feinstein and get her to step down from being chairman of the Judiciary Committee because she was unable to carry out her duties as chairman. And it was a terrible situation. I had to keep talking to her, and then she would forget that he'd spoken to her. And another colleague said to me, it was harder than trying to take the keys away from your parents.
I do think there's a kind of broader cultural issue that we haven't really touched on, which is sort of, effectively the disenfranchisement of the young, sort of the inability of people to kind of pass on the baton generationally. I mean, you could really approve of Biden's performance, although most Americans do not, but you still would wonder, doesn't the Democratic Party have more of a young bench of people who really want to be coming up? And you think, I mean, people may have seen the Futurama episode from the 90s that kind of comes out of the Reagan moment, and Richard Nixon's disembodied head kept in a jar runs for president and wins, attached to the robotic body of Spiro, the headless robotic body of Spiro Agnew.
Of Earth.
Nixon's back!
And that's how kind of that Simpsons generation of writers who grew up in the Reagan era pictured the future of American politics. We'd be, running against the dead head of Richard Nixon. And I think for young people, it feels that way.
Who's kicking who around now?
It raises questions to me somewhat about why is it that the Senate is so old and our candidates seem so old, and is it not to some extent a reflection of a systemic problem that is also a problem with our democracy here, which is that incumbency is such an advantage at this point because of our campaign finance system. You get mm-hmm. It's so much easier to get reelected when you're in office. And when you're the longer you're in office, you get more seniority. It gets easier and easier to raise funds. All the lobbyists throw money at you when you're a committee chairman. And I think the process is, it leads to gerontocracy. It's very hard to unseat someone.
Now, on the other hand, Jill, I have to think, and I don't know historically whether age has been used as a weapon in presidential campaigns, but I can't imagine that if Ron DeSantis gets the nomination in 2024, we won't hear about Biden's age a lot.
Yeah, I don't think there's a real political price to be paid for calling attention to someone's age, right? I just, we could say that's ageism. Your other guests could say that's ageism, but I don't know that there's you know, at the level of vote getting, anything but an advantage to make an issue of someone's age.
Except, I mean, there Reagan famously deflected
that.
The script,
yeah,
right?
He was really effective at that.
Campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Now, does Biden have the nimbleness to pull one of those moves?
No, and I don't think you can do it at 80. Honestly, like, I just don't think you can do it at 80. But I think Jane's exactly right about the structural problems with our democracy. And I would add to that, though, the diminished number of young people who are going into public service, because our political culture is just vicious. It's, you know, it's like, it's specifically violent, among other things, but there's not a lot of dignity in American political life, right? Like, if you're a person who sort of walks through life with a certain kind of reserve and a sort of integrity of your family life, look at who wants that?
Well, Jill, you've been teaching young students year after year. Do you sense that fewer and fewer of your best students want to go into politics?
Yeah, you never hear from young people who... You hear from a lot of people who want to run campaigns. People who want to do behind-the-scenes consulting sorts of things. Although I will say, just recently, this was one of the kind of great, to me, surprising knock-on effects of the George Floyd moment. I have a lot of young African-American men, male students, who want to run for office. But those guys, they all want Biden to step down. I mean, I just feel I do not talk to young people who are excited about Biden running for re-election. And it's not because they don't appreciate that he did the great good work of defeating Donald Trump, or that he hasn't had, a fairly successful first term. But they feel kind of renounced. There's no political space for them. There's this giant generation missing. It's not so much them. Obviously, they're not running for office yet, but they don't see people in their 30s and 40s. That's the sort of, I think, analytically, that is actually the missing piece in American political life.
I couldn't agree more. I was so shocked. I remember interviewing Obama on his way out, and obviously most of the conversation was this kind of mournful subtext about the incoming president, Trump. But when I asked him who was on the bench in the Democratic Party, he could barely think of any names. That's the president of the United States, the leader of the Democratic Party. He could barely think of any names. Oh, yeah, who's that guy who's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, et cetera. It was incredible. And you think, Jill, that's because there's such a disincentive that's enforced by this gerontocracy.
Yeah, and by the nature of the political culture, by just this sort of the social media driven kind of doxing, destroy your life world that we live in, makes a lot of people want to work behind the scenes in whatever they do.
Whether conventional wisdom is correct or not, I keep reading that if Kamala Harris had been put in place as vice president to be a successor figure, that has fizzled in large measure. So that conventional wisdom goes. If, assuming that Biden runs, will anybody challenge him from within the party?
It's hard for me to imagine they won't. You've got so many ambitious people. I don't know if it'll be somebody who's respected and really can get far, but it just seems like an open invitation for somebody. I think that the dynamic that is interesting with Biden in age is that if it winds up that he is running against Trump again, I don't think age is going to be a big issue. Trump's really not that much younger than Biden is. Where it becomes a big issue is if it's DeSantis or somebody who's much younger. Mm-hmm. Then I think it's going to really be baggage for the Democrats.
You agree, Jill?
I think if it's Trump versus Biden, age won't be an issue between them, but age will be an issue for American voters who will be really frustrated. I mean, I just think of the young people that I teach every day. They will be furious. They will be furious. Can't these people step down and get out of the way? You hear that all the time, and I'm with them there. I'm just not persuaded that there's enthusiasm for Biden. So
the polls certainly don't reflect it.
Yeah, you take that, and then you imagine being 19 and voting for the first time, and you're looking at Trump versus Biden again. I just think that's a kind of political despair that fuels the political apathy of a non-voting young person in a way the country can't afford.
Jillipore, Jane Mayer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Staff writers Jane Mayer and Jillipore. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Age of Vice is a novel just published this month. Now, I hate the word buzzy, which seems a little trite for a serious book, but Age of Vice was published in 20 countries simultaneously, which is hard to do for an author who isn't named, say, James Patterson. The story takes place in New Delhi, the capital of India, and it's part crime thriller, part family saga. The author is Deepti Kapoor, who spent a decade as a journalist in Delhi, and she moves the action in Age of Vice between the poorest of the poor and the richest of the rich. Deepti Kapoor talked this week with Parul Sehgal, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker covering literature and much more.
So Age of Vice by Deepti Kapoor is this really fast-paced, shadowy novel that begins at 3 a.m. on a Delhi street. This Mercedes has mowed down five people. The novel then jumps back and tells a story with three different points of view. There's Ajay, servant. There's Sunny, this reckless playboy, and Neda, a journalist who's caught up in the story. You know, it's gauche to say that one of the reasons I'm drawn to this book is not a biographical element. I lived in Delhi at the same time. I remember the pace of this. I remember the pulse, the harshness, but also the wildness. I recognize this Delhi. And the book itself is this big, copious embrace of so many different kinds of storytelling. It feels like a thriller. It feels like true crime. There's autobiography that is woven through it. And it's sort of trying to capture as many different ways of telling this story.
I mean, I should mention here that I know you.
Yeah.
No, I partied with you in your 20s a little bit.
Yeah.
I knew you in Delhi right about the time that this novel is set. And Delhi itself is such a big, brawny character in this book. But I think for people that know Delhi, this book is full of longing for it in a way that took my breath away. There's a section where you just conjure the winter mornings when you take the woolens out of the trunk. Tell me about the Delhi that you wanted to put on the page with this book.
Yeah, I mean, Delhi is this itch I constantly need to scratch. I think it's because where I came of age in the city. I came of age in the early aughts when Delhi was transforming from this very sleepy, sedate city, post-liberalization with all the money that flowed in suddenly, with all the building that started, with all the capital, with all the global companies that started coming in. Gurgaon, which was farmland and is now this what can I call it, monstrous city. I wanted to capture the pain and the pleasure of living in Delhi. You know, the pleasure of driving those streets late at night, the pain that came when you realize that all those years of excess and privilege were accounted for by someone else. So that's what I was trying to get. It was this novel was also written as my way of not atoning, but accounting for those years.
Mm. Yeah, and Delhi is a place that changes you.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. It's both extremely beautiful, but also violent. It's unjust. It's desperately unequal. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, it's like it's a place where you think you're going to get cheated and robbed until someone does something incredibly kind and breaks your heart.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a heartbreaking city.
Yeah, yeah. And I think for this book, I mean, in both your books, A Bad Character and in this one, the style is the story for me. And the style is so different. And one of my favorite things is following novelists who change it up. But I did want to ask you about this style. Was it a conscious choice, or was it a choice that was it a rhythm that started to emerge once you were already in these characters' lives and telling these stories?
That's a really interesting question, and I think novelists always say that when they don't know the answer to questions. No,
so fair.
No. But no, my process is often quite chaotic and unpredictable. I don't plan. I make notes that I never look at again, but. Part of it is, I think, just your rational self playing against your subconscious, especially with the characters. Mm. It's like you create them, and then this seems like really silly, but then they do actually start doing things that you hadn't predicted. Sometimes I think of it like artificial intelligence, where you've created a program, you run the program, and then the characters become sentient. They start, they gain consciousness, and then you're basically just trying to control them. And I think that happened towards the latter half of the book. And that's also why the style changed.
Yeah, it feels inevitable, too, because like a book of this size, which I think, you know, it's just, there's such amplitude here, and it's the product of many, many years. How long were you writing this book?
Well, 4 years.
4 years.
But I think it's 20 years in the making, right. In terms of all the stories and everything.
And you didn't write this book in India, is that right? Where were you living when you
started
writing
this? So I had just moved. I left India in 2018. I had the idea by then. I'd started working on it. But I moved to Lisbon in Portugal. And again, it was because my husband is British. We wanted to get European residency before Brexit. We didn't have the kind of... I have an Indian passport, which is not a great one. So it was actually really good to move away. And I was full off the world. But not being in the world really helped.
Say more about that. Say more. Like, were there things that you were able to think, imagine, or say about this world that came easier because you were far away?
I think I was bolder,
yeah.
More radical.
Yeah.
And I think that if I was writing it in India, it would have been a different novel. Mm. And I don't know how, but I know it. You know, I know it's just my instinct saying that, but I have a very strong feeling it would have been a very different novel. Maybe it wouldn't have been as, I don't know, I hate to use this word radical, but it was just that I had, you know, I just didn't care so much because I really wanted to, get it right. And I still think I haven't got it right, but yeah, being away helped.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine writing it in India. It would be hard to banish the feeling of all those eyes.
Yeah,
right. And
basically,
all of those,
that's
like,
it.
But you didn't represent this in this particular way. And how could you say this? And you know, maybe being away allowed you some freedom. I mean, which leads me to another question I want to ask you. I don't know if you said this to me or in an interview, but you once said, around the time of the publication of your first book, that it was important for you to be apart from a scene. You didn't want to know too many writers.
Yeah.
You know, that it was a way for you to feel brave and for you to feel free. Is that still true?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's really important to not hang out with other writers.
Goodbye, Diti.
you're yeah. Critic.
I'm the exception. It's true. Yeah.
Unless you've known people before you became a writer. Mm. So then that doesn't... You know, that disqualifies you anyway. So I think it's because I like to hang out with you know, and hopefully none of the people I steal from are going to be listening to this, but just people who don't actually, you know, who have these very interesting lives. And they could be anyone. They could be DJs or they could be party people. I often hang out with drivers. They tell me all kinds of crazy stories. And then if you hang out with other writers, where are you going to get the stories from? So
where are you going to steal unnoticed from? But we've talked about stealing. We've talked about spying and looking and listening and gathering.
Yeah.
And you, you know, you've returned to, I mean, it's strange to talk about crime as if it's like a special topic when you're talking about Delhi, because crime is so foundational in Delhi. Like, it's not something that you're bringing into the story. It's there. You look at any story, it's going to be a story of corruption. It's going to be a story of something like this. But one of the things I was curious about is, you know, when you're speaking to people now in America and you're speaking to journalists and you're seeing reviews, are American readers noticing or alighting upon something different than Indian readers are?
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me.
So Americans just love the hero's journey, and that's Ajay. So it's all about Ajay. And this has been happening. It's not just Americans, it's the Europeans as well. I've also been working on an adaptation with FX, and all the TV people are obsessed with Ajay. Indians, not so much. They're looking at it as a story that plays out in modern India. It's a story about corruption, about power, about what's going on right now, the relationship between mafias and the state. So they're much more interested in the themes. It's very interesting, actually. I never imagined this response and this difference in the response. And I think Indians are rightfully suspicious of Indian writers who they think are writing for the West.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you have to convince them that it's not just a book written for the West.
And how does one begin to do that, Deepthi?
I have absolutely no idea. I don't know. I just hope I've managed to please a few readers in India.
Mm.
Can't say.
With Neda, I think in certain ways there might be the most overlap, and I suppose there is. But I would love to know a little bit more about how your own work as a journalist informed the writing of this particular book. Did it help? Was it helpful? Was it something that you had to unlearn also? Because journalism does teach us ways of thinking and ways of presenting information. How was that for you?
I was a bad journalist. So there you go. I spent a lot of time driving in my car, apparently trying to figure out what was going on in the city, which I did. I think what I was good at was just observing people and disappearing in a space and then just being there. But I'm not very good at doggedly kind of like pursuing a story. You know, I'd rather just hang out with people and be in a state of being than actually pursue that story, which is why I think I'm better at writing fiction than nonfiction.
I mean, one of the things I think your book does so well is it looks at how, you know, new power relations are coming into countries like India and subverting some old relationships, strengthening others, monkeying with it in all kinds of ways, you know? And it's the sort of thing that, you know, one could easily, you know, write an op-ed about, write an essay about. What does the novel allow you to do?
I think it allows me to tell a story, but not the story, you know? Yeah. And I think if it allows me to create these characters for which, you know, someone can feel empathy for, someone can imagine the world, even for a few hours, you know, someone who has absolutely no idea, maybe, and learns. I mean, I hate to use that word, learning, because that's not what the novel is about, right?
It's tricky because I mean, again, to use another word that I don't think you would ever use, but you're trying to rouse people or wake them, but not in that kind of usual way. Like, it's, I don't know. Implicate them, maybe. Involve them.
Yeah, I think so.
You know?
Maybe indict them.
Indict them, entrap them. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's more appropriate. And I had that awakening when after the Jyoti Singh rape and murder and the subsequent protests, I was sort of shaken.
Yeah, this is the gang rape of Jyoti Singh in 2012 on the bus.
Yeah. It feels like it was this moment for India, like similar to maybe the Manson murders. And, you know, something happened, something shifted. Mm. And I remember thinking that I wasn't interested in just writing these solipsistic novels anymore. I had to kind of like get involved, you know, and find a way to write about what was happening. Mm-hmm. So if I can do that, then that's for me, it's a part success.
Is the language also part of it? Like, this book is very inviting, you know, and it keeps you reading. And I was thinking about the relationship between, and it's almost like a queasy balance between how entertaining it is and the difficult truths it has to tell, you know? And I was wondering what it would be like to sit with that and just to say, like, I have to share these scenes. I have to keep you with me. You know?
And that's when it becomes challenging, because that's when, you know, you could just be tempted to just be like, I'm going to tell Ajay's story and I'm going to make it this big adventure sort of novel about this young boy and then how he rises up the ranks and then this happens and then he gets revenge. But I just didn't want to do that. And that's when it does become challenging, because you're trying to find a way to incorporate all the other things you want to say. And while at the same time, you want to keep it propulsive, you want to keep it thrilling, but it's not like a thriller. So it's always very interesting for me when it's being sold as one.
Why isn't it a thriller?
Okay, it's a political thriller. I take that back. It's a thriller.
You concede.
Everyone buy it. It's a thriller. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, Deepti.
Thanks for having me, Parul. It's a real pleasure to speak with you.
Parul Sehgal, who's a staff writer and critic at The New Yorker, speaking with novelist Deepti Kapoor. Age of Ice came out this month. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Imputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Kiefline, Mike Kutchman, and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.